Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. While our politics have moved further and further to the right over the last few decades, we'll look into the apparent shift that indicates the American people are starting to move to the left. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, joins us to discuss the new blue America that will get bluer and how much our purple president will shift with the progressive wind. Then we will speak with University of Indianapolis presidential historian Edward France, the author of The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy. We will discuss the current fratricide and recrimination inside the Republican Party and assess whether the GOP can reverse course in its march to the right to rediscover its progressive roots as the party of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt. Then finally, we'll look into the surging tide of women candidates swept into office in the recent election and speculate whether the ultimate glass ceiling, the election of a woman as president of the United States, is about to crack. Jo Freeman, an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney, joins us to discuss the emerging new majority of women, the young, and minorities, and whether the Republicans will come back in 2014. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Good to be back with you, Ian. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. And if you were on the Senate in your old job as counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, you'd be working overtime now, right?
I guess that's right. Although I don't really know how much this has to do with intelligence and intelligence policy. I think that some Republicans, conservatives might want to use this to embarrass the president, but I think that it really should be pushed aside. There are legitimate questions about Benghazi and of course, about our intelligence operations generally. But the bad judgment of the director of Central Intelligence on a personal matter, I think, is not really something, or the former director, that critical. And I think that the idea of embarrassing innocent family members in this any further seems like something that Congress ought to think twice about, especially until they get their own house in order on these kind of things.
Well, it wouldn't have happened, but for the fact that there was a zealous right-wing FBI agent who thought that this involved a cover-up over Benghazi, which, of course, obviously, if you watch Fox News, that's the lead story every night for the last month. Yeah. And he apparently went to Eric Cantor, the House Republican whip, and that's why this, I think, became a scandal.
I guess so. Well, I don't know exactly what forced it out, but he may have been zealous right-wing, or he may have just continue to be love-struck by this woman that apparently everyone in the world is in love with.
This new breed of groupies.
She just, I guess, is irresistible.
Right. But the idea
makes men do crazy things.
Yeah, but the idea that, you know, I know about groupies for rock stars, you know, but I've never heard of groupies for generals.
There are groupies for almost any class of person. And then the men on the other side of it act like idiots no matter what their status.
Sure. Well, David, let's talk about something real here. And even though, of course, scandal trumps substance, as we all know, we are not France, as it happens. But tell me, what do you make of the possibility that we now, from this last election, we clearly have a blue majority in this country? And it is, according to demographics, it's likely to get bigger and bluer over the years. And as you know, the Republican Party are going through all kinds of recriminations, and people like Steve Schmidt are accusing Limbaugh and company, who are in many ways the de facto heads of the Republican Party, of being the Republican entertainment complex, and that they're destroying the Republican Party. And then conversely, Limbaugh and company are all saying that they're being scapegoated for candidates who aren't conservative enough, and so on and so on. So while one party is going through fratricide, the other party, you would think, would be on a roll. But there's a certain concern that a lot of people have that we have a blue America, but we may have a purple president. And he may unilaterally give in on something like Social Security unnecessarily. What's your sense of disquiet in that regard?
Well, I do think we are developing a blue America because I think that there are too many people that find it unacceptable that the Republican Party is held hostage to things like continuing to give tax cuts for the rich that are just more than we can afford, that is anti-choice and says that a woman has to bear a child when she was raped, that has a touch of sort of Rush Limbaugh bigotry, that is anti-immigrant. So I do think we are moving in a direction where there's and it is intolerant of freedom to marry for all people, including LGBT people. So I do think we're moving to a place where young people, immigrants, people of color, and a good number of working people generally, including white working people, as well as educated people, are tired of those Republican limits on freedom and on justice, and on a rational society. So that's good. As far as what then the president will do with that, because I think the president is a progressive, I agree. There's a chance that he's hemmed in some ways, or perceives that he's hemmed in or wants to be, by the influence of big business that sometimes has America's interest at heart and sometimes on some issues does not, by people telling him, maybe pushing too hard on fiscal things that don't necessarily need to be so buttoned up, in the sense that we probably could afford a little bit more stimulus right now or could use it for our economy. And by other things that, could lead him to be a second-term purple president. On the other hand, you do have a House majority of Republicans. You do have the undeniable influence of business in a post-Citizens United world. They may not have won the election, but they can get in the airwaves and try to influence everything the president does on issues like health care, climate change, the budget. And it may be that, that he will have to settle for something that isn't what all the progressives who voted for him wanted, and that he still will have done the best that he can.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, senior fellow at the Republic Report, and he was previously a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, in terms of your old boss, President Clinton, in many ways he was a purple president, certainly in his second term. And both he and Barack Obama have stated that in many ways their political outlook was informed by Ronald Reagan. And, of course, they grew up in the Reagan era and came of age as politicians in the Reagan era. But arguably the Reagan era is over. This is a whole new ballgame. And again, I'm wondering whether they are dealing with a polity that is extinct.
Well, I believe that when they expressed admiration for President Reagan, it was for his, the way he was perceived, at least, as a success, rather than really sharing his values. But it's also true that he did, because Reagan kind of moved the rhetoric and the sense of political possibility, they do feel hemmed in, and they do feel, I think, that if you push too hard leftward, you may end up a bigger failure. And I think that, I think that maybe President Obama does feel a little of that left over from, what he saw in the Clinton years. Clinton moved to the right. He did welfare reform. People resigned his administration in protest. He made budget deals with Newt Gingrich and came out, triumphant. And notwithstanding impeachment, it seemed as a very successful president. So I do think that Obama, there's a temptation to say, if you push too hard left, you may end up with a failed presidency where you accomplish not enough. I think it is really interesting to see what Obama decides to do, because I do think he's a progressive. I do think there are things as a progressive that he would like to accomplish and that progressives would like him to accomplish, on protecting the rights of working people, on advancing civil rights, continuing to fight for civil rights. And so I think I do think it'll be interesting to see where he comes out. I would like to see him fight. I do believe, as you say, we have a more blue America. It may not have the money, but it has power, and it's shown a willingness to organize and to vote. And if the president does stand up for some important progressive goals in his second term, that he would get a lot of support from the American people. And I think it's worth a shot. I think just lowering your sights and saying, the real president is Pete Peterson, and his foundation to cut the deficit, or the real president is the Chamber of Commerce right across the street from the White House with all their money. That would be disappointing, and it would be bad for all the people who work so hard to elect the president.
Well, it seems, David Halperin, that our politics have moved inexorably to the right, and the Republican Party itself has moved so far to the right that people like Steve Schmidt and others are now calling out the so-called the Republican entertainment complex, the Limbaughs, etc. So there's no question that the Republican Party's moved to the right, the Democrats moved to the right, but the country seems to be moving to the left, and that's what I'm suggesting here, that, you know, maybe it's safer to tack back, and or maybe it's actually more in line with where the country's going.
The problem that they face, I think on issues like gay marriage and immigration, I think they can overcome the opposition and keep on pushing in a more progressive, inclusive direction for our country. And I don't think that that will be as big a challenge for the president as things where you're taking on rich people and business interests. So the taxes, but I do think now there's a mandate, which I think he will get, that rich people are going to have to pay a little bit more taxes. I think the real challenges come on issues where it's not just an ideological conservative position, but it's a pro-corporate, Koch brothers, ExxonMobil, lobbying, you know, Washington Power, those kind of issues. It's going to be tougher for the president to take on, you know, the corporate lobbyists and all the money they have and all their ability to create fake grassroots campaigns and advertisements on TV and give campaign contributions. That whole world of money-dominating politics, I think, is the toughest thing for the president to overcome, because it doesn't matter as much there that a majority of voters voted for the progressive, more progressive candidate. What matters there the most, unfortunately, is the influence of big money and their ability to punish people who stand up against them. And that's where I'd like to see the president get tougher, take a tougher stand. And I do think that, like you say, the people are on the progressive side of those issues. And it's just, it will take communications challenge and organizing challenge, and it'll take courage for the president to stand up against those interests on continuing to protect, to provide more health insurance for people and control the costs of health care, on making sure that, you know, my favorite issue, of course, is protecting against the rip-off for-profit colleges that have been wasting so much of our tax money. And really maybe the biggest issue is on dealing with the issue of climate change and having a more rational energy policy that takes into account how much dirty energy actually hurts people. And at this point, many of the big energy companies free ride off that. And the president needs to stand up, do something like have a carbon tax, or have a cap-and-trade system, or otherwise work to make sure that we're not continuing to move in a direction where our energy has such huge costs, such as the cost right now being faced by people in New York, New Jersey, because of the storm, which clearly, you know, it seems to a lot of experts, was a result of the fact that we're using too much dirty energy, and it's leading to global warming.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, Senior Fellow at Republic Report, and previously was a White House speechwriter and Special Assistant for National Security Affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, the reason that we have this so-called fiscal cliff in the first place is because the deal wasn't made back in 2011 when the Tea Party in the Republican House took the entire nation to the brink of losing its full faith and credit. And, of course, we know that our debt was downgraded as a result of that. And because they couldn't reach a deal, they came up with this sequester arrangement that has now been dubbed the fiscal cliff. And, again, in many ways, that feels to me like playing into the Pete Peterson deficit hawk milieu, the idea that the sky is falling. But one of the things I find troubling about those negotiations back then was that apparently the president put quite a lot on the table in terms of Social Security and Medicare. And now that we have a different political arrangement in Washington as a result of this election, what's your sense about what's going to be on the table? Because it would seem to me they're talking about a grand bargain, but a lot of other people are talking about this could be the great betrayal.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's on the table then. I don't know what the president's willing to do. I hope he will stand with the seniors who have worked so hard and expected Social Security and even younger people who you know been putting money into that system for so long, and may have no other, unlike Mitt Romney, may not have any other source of income in retirement. I hope he will stand with people that depend on Medicare and Medicaid to make sure that they're not having to choose between eating dinner and seeing a doctor. I think that those people are, you know, the reason that government exists is in many respects is to make sure that those people, you know, have a decent life and that we can afford in this affluent country that we've built, notwithstanding the economic downturn in recent years, to make sure that we take care of those people. And I think the president can and will, I believe he will, not sell out those people, and that there's room in this to make sure that the rich pay more taxes, to look for cuts. Frankly, I think we could cut a lot of defense at this point, buying a lot of weapons systems that we don't necessarily need, given the threats that we face right now. Look for other ways to do this without making it a betrayal. And I'm not going to say now that I'm sure the president will betray people on that, because I think that I want to believe that he's a good person. When I ran Campus Progress for 8 years, he came to spoken to of our events, was very inspiring. I got to talk with him a little bit. I think he's a good person, a progressive, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt that he will take his electoral victory and use it to vindicate the interests of people who stood with him and who supported him and who don't want to see us sell out the most vulnerable people in our society.
So given what you've just said, David Halper, then perhaps the onus is on the people who help bring about this blue America, this emerging new progressive majority, the young, the minorities and the women in this country who showed up. And of course, more of them showed up in 2008, and many abdicated as a result of disappointment that the president who was supposed to bring about hope and change was mortal and somehow didn't deliver on everything that everybody was hoping for. And I recall the famous adage of FDR during the Depression, when progressives came to him and wanted to be more aggressive, and he said, make me do it. And, is this a time, for in other words, for people to put the wind at the president's back and stand with him and not be so petulant?
I think that people have to be the president's friend and give him the benefit of the doubt, but also push him. On the conservative side, you'll see if a Republican president like George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush takes a stand that looks like they're compromising, you will see conservatives, the hardline conservatives, and even the professional conservatives, and certainly the corporate conservatives, can go nuts and be really tough and not be so, not just shut up. And that helps. That's right. That what Roosevelt said is right. I got in trouble a couple years ago at work because I criticized the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, because she voted with for-profit colleges, but I thought she had done the wrong thing, and all I said was we were disappointed. And some people at my work didn't like that I said that, but I thought it was an important thing to do to say, when they'd asked me a year earlier to say something nice about Leader Pelosi, I did. I thought she was terrific, and I thought that she should stay as the leader, notwithstanding the disappointing results in the 2008 election. But the next year, when she voted a way that I didn't think was right, I thought it was my responsibility as an advocate for young people at the time to speak out against what she did. And you know what? She didn't turn her back on our organization. I think it's okay when the Republicans always come in and say, look, we'd love to compromise, but we've got Grover Norquist, Rush Limbaugh, all these people. That is a plus for them to be able to say that they're feeling that pressure. They can only go so far. So I think tough love for the president from progressives is a good thing. To say that we give him the benefit of the doubt and that we're glad that he was elected, but at the same time to be able to say, if we disagree with him, we disagree with you, and if you go too far, if you sell out our interests, we will organize, we will speak out, we'll get things done. I think that's part of democracy. So when people say, shut up, Obama can only do so much, don't criticize him, I don't think that is helping him. I think President Roosevelt and you hit it right on the head.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, David Halpern.
Ian, it's great to be on the show.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, and White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll come back and look into the current fratricide and recrimination inside the Republican Party.
The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward France.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And your book, of course, is about the Southern strategy, and it's pretty clear the Republican Party has essentially become a Southern party. In fact, it was pointed out that the map of this last election, the red versus the blue, was almost identical to the map of the United States on the eve of the Civil War. So what do you make of that?
It's striking, isn't it? I mean, it really would, if you could have done time travel, people just really would not have believed the political transformation, the geographical transformation. And, I mean, I think there certainly that was part of the strategy. I don't think anybody could have imagined in the 1870s when the end of Reconstruction really caused the need for this strategy to at least be experimented with, that it could have been so widely successful in the 21st century as far as the Republican Party's base in the South. So it's been dramatic indeed, that's for sure.
But not without consequences. There is a certain amount of fratricide going on within Republican ranks following this last election. One of the people that ran the John McCain's campaign in 2008, Steve Schmidt, who's a commentator on MSNBC, he was on the Sunday talk shows a week or so ago, where he referred to the people that are dominating the current Republican Party as the conservative entertainment complex, referring to the Fox News commentators and Rush Limbaugh. Where do you think this argument is heading?
Well, as you know, historians are always better looking backward rather than forward. But, you know, I think there's one part of me that says let's put the brakes on all of this discussion about the decline of the Republican Party. Because even in my lifetime, I can remember not that long ago when people were wanting to write that same obituary for the Democratic Party, and that was in 2004, right? When you had a Republican reelected to a second term with control of both the House and the Senate. So there's one part of me that says, you know, this is the natural time when a party that loses on the presidential level really tries to figure out how did we get here and what went wrong. And we tend to perhaps overemphasize the extent of the defeat. But I do think it is an interesting moment right now for the Republican Party, and it's a moment in which many of the ideas that have that really resonated and provided goals for a generation or two of politicians limited government, winnowing down on many of these things, and strong foreign policy have reached in many ways their culmination as far as their usefulness in the presidential election. At least it looks that way. So basically, the Ronald Reagan playbook, to put it another way, looks like it would be hard to use 4 more years down the road. And so then what you do in its place, what does the Republican Party want to be? That's a question, of course, that's really fascinating to anybody who's observed politics over any length of time.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last 2 centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Now, in terms of the Reagan legacy, surely the President George W. Bush, if you say that it's been about limiting government and having strong foreign policy, George W. Bush increased government, increased the deficit, and was ruinous in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Is that what's changing the Republican Party?
I think there's an outgrowth of that. And, that's something the argument you just made there in an incredibly short period of time there, Ian, is one that in red state America, Democrats still have trouble pointing out, right? I mean, I think there still is... And that would be reasons why Republicans probably would have hope right now, right, is that the difficult financial situation that has existed over the last 4 years, and that's clearly an understatement, has been pinned successfully in the South and in Indiana and some other red states on the current administration rather than the Bush administration, as you hinted at. And if that's the case, that would suggest they're not quite as dead as some of the pundits might have you believe.
Well, certainly, in terms of the popular vote, there was a 3 million difference. So
yeah.
It's not nobody can suggest that this was some vast sea change in America where America suddenly turned blue. It certainly did in the Electoral College, but not in the popular vote. So. What then do you make, Edward France, of the arguments amongst a lot of Republicans saying, and fairly prominent ones, saying that the party can't afford and cannot sustain itself over the long term if it is hostile to women and minorities?
Well, that's where I think were the party to invest a lot of effort, a lot of time, not just rhetoric, but effort in saying that this party has an incredibly strong history as a leader in expanding rights. You have to go back a ways, and many people alive today don't have memory of that. But if you go back a ways, that is a proud tradition. And I think the Republican Party at its best has been about helping to increase those rights, leading the way, and really being the only ones responsible for getting the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment ratified and becoming law, helping to contribute with key votes in Congress on the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which absolutely had the support and leadership of Lyndon Johnson, but when it came to votes within the Congress, couldn't have been done without Republicans. From time to time, the current Republican Party will mention that, but when they do, it tends to be in a pretty dismissive or half-hearted way, and it has not been effective at all. And so certainly they could connect their future to their past. And for a historian, then that is something we're deeply interested in seeing, that people who move forward do so on the basis of what has happened before rather than just on dreaming a utopia.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward France, who's a presidential historian. He teaches at the University of Indianapolis and has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last 2 centuries. His newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. Now, you had a ringside seat there in Indianapolis, Indiana, in terms of this last election where a kind of icon of Republican moderation, Senator Lugar, who was very much the elder statesman of the United States Senate. He got unceremoniously defeated in the primary by Richard Murdoch, who was less than gracious in his victory. And then he, of course, was way ahead of the Democrat in this fairly red state, Indiana. And then he, of course, expressed his personal beliefs on rape and conception as a result of rape, which obviously backfired. One of the things I found strange about that was, though, that this man was actually telling the truth about what he really believes, you know. He got soundly ridiculed. But in many ways, you know, I prefer a politician like that, even though I disagree with what he's saying immensely, to a politician that might appear to be a moderate Republican, or actually might be a moderate Republican, but goes along with the anti-abortion dogma in order to preserve his seat. So how's that going to pan out in terms of true believers versus the more pragmatic and perhaps even cynical politicians?
Well, that's where you always, if you look in the past, the true believers always feel like they've been scorned, then if they just do things right the next time, they'll really have it work. And of course, many of those true believers then nominated, you know, we're going back to another time period, nominated Barry Goldwater as their candidate. And if we really just nominated the perfect candidate for the cause of limited government, you know, the ideas would circulate. And that was in response to what they saw as a generation of only moderate Republicans who were not true conservatives. And we saw how that worked out. So within Indiana, I mean, I understand exactly your take on Richard Murdoch was inarticulate. I think for anybody for whom he wasn't on the ballot, it's very easy. So people watching nationally, it's very easy to outsiders for that to look like a farce and to make it into a farce. But, you know, in many ways, that was tragedy unfolding that a person I would argue with you that, you know, he was being honest and that's credible. But that these ideas that he espoused, which are so far out of the mainstream, could be ones that, you know, a candidate for the United States Senate would hold is pretty striking. And certainly then to Hoosiers who had not warmed up to the idea of a Murdoch representing them in the state, that was all the permission they needed finally to say, all right, we can't go from Richard Lugar, as you said, the elder statesman in many ways of the Senate, to Richard Murdoch. Yes, they share the same first name and allegedly the same party, but people just couldn't see that happening. And I guess the last bit that I would add to that is, you know, the candidate he was running against, I think that's a big portion of why Richard Murdoch felt like he had to do what he did, because the Democrat that he was running against, to many liberals, wasn't liberal enough. He's a blue dog Democrat who is pro-life, right? So how do you distinguish yourself? You're even more ardently pro-life, and that probably got him to the position that he was in with that statement.
Well, clearly the defeat of Murdoch and Aiken, and then going back to the previous election, Sharon Angle and the strange witch lady in Delaware, mm-hmm. Has led a lot of the current Republican pundits to basically say, you know, this is why we've got to, you know, clean up our house, because we're losing. We could have won the Senate, but for these extreme candidates. And now you've got Rush Limbaugh getting incredibly defensive and saying, you know, they're trying to blame me for the election loss, you know. And again, in the context of what's been being described as the conservative entertainment complex. It does lead one to question, though, the fact that Limbaugh and Hannity and these characters and Karl Rove, too, have so much influence. It makes you wonder who's running the show. I mean, is this a party without a leadership? Is this a party where talk show hosts and fundraisers have more influence than the nominal head of the party?
At this moment, a week away from Mitt Romney's, to them, devastating defeat, in this moment, yes, because
can you just say 2 weeks away, because this is being broadcast next week.
Sorry. Okay. Right. Yeah. So 2 weeks from now, when we still haven't had anybody to emerge, yes. I mean, I think you see a moment right now where Speaker of the House Boehner certainly hopes that he can position himself to be that voice for the Republican Party, and that perhaps the negotiations over the fiscal cliff can provide an opportunity for some Republicans who fashion themselves as being sane and results-oriented to come together and forge a solution. And out of that predicament, if things go well, then you could see perhaps the reclaiming of the leader, the mantleship of leadership by politicians rather than by their allies in conservative media. But I think right now one of the things that's interesting is that you don't get widespread circulation right now of conservative ideas that are actually ideas where you have intellectuals leading that. For a long time, people made the argument that William F. Buckley and other conservatives really had an agenda, whether you liked it or not, where they were advancing a lot of ideas and conservative ideas and developing think tanks to do that. You don't have somebody who you can take seriously as an intellectual right now advancing arguments that would run counter to Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, and that's unfortunate. There certainly are those people who are out there, but they don't have the platform, they don't have the visibility, and partially it's because they've also been co-opted by that system and appear as guests on those already established shows where they can separate themselves. And maybe there's an opportunity for those kind of ideological leaders to come together with some of the politicians who lament where they are to forge some sort of new coalition for the Republican Party moving forward. But it is really hard to imagine the current situation of the Republican Party resulting in a strong candidate 4 years from now at the moment that we are in here post-election 2012.
And of course, Edward France, John Boehner is looking over his shoulder at Eric Cantor, who is clearly very ambitious and is out for his job. So we have to hold our breath in that regard.
Yeah, and we'll see. I think probably a three-headed monster vying for leadership, I would imagine, of where you have not only Eric Cantor over one shoulder and Paul Ryan over another. And there are visions of a future party that people have there, and then maybe in the Senate with Marco Rubio, where they like to imagine a knight in shining armor coming in on a white horse to save the day. But you know, there's so many unknowns about what unfolds both in the immediate and then intermediate future that it's really tough to say, well, this is how it's going to go. But I certainly do hope that what people are realizing is, I think if you look at the Tea Party as a populist movement, and I think at its roots it was, those over the course of American history also have ebbed and flowed, right? And the Republican Party a century ago responded to populists who in parts of the country thought that the Republican Party was the enemy. And that was, you know, in the 1890s and when populism spread. So I find it you know, populism often yields dramatic short-term results, but it's hard to channel that into something meaningful. And then you either, as you said, have the true believers who want to remain pure, or the good portion of it, a lot of the energy, enthusiasm, can get co-opted by the larger movement. So I find that part, again, instructive how our past can inform our present, perhaps our future.
Well, Edward France, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward France, who is a presidential historian who teaches at the University of Indianapolis. He has written widely on how the American presidency has changed in the last two centuries, and his newest book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, is just out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the influx of women into the new Congress and whether the presidential glass ceiling will soon be broken.
So let's abandon that track and leave our fathers fighting in a sack.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jo Freeman, an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. As a student at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s, she became active in organizations working for civil liberties and the civil rights movement. She went on to do voter registration and community organization in Alabama and Mississippi and was an early organizer of the Women's Liberation Movement. She has authored several classic feminist books and articles, as well as important papers on social movements and political parties. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jo Freeman.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And these elections, of course, brought in a number of women into and minorities into the House of Representatives and into the United States Senate. In fact, the entire makeup of representatives in the state of New Hampshire appear to be almost entirely women. So how do you feel about these results in terms of America turning blue and getting bluer in the future?
Well, first of all, this was definitely a very good year for women. We increased our representation in the House, in the Senate, and generally throughout. It's usually a good year for women when it's a year that ends in two, and it's usually a good year for women running for office when the Democrats do well. The Democrats did well. They didn't do as well as they perhaps could have, but they did better than most people expected them to do. So the American people essentially said that they wanted more progressivism in their policies than they've been experiencing in the past. They did not reverse the Republican ascendancy in the House. That is still going to be a problem. But they gave us a few more Democrats to work with than we had before.
Now, what do you make, then, of this idea that the our politics have moved so far to the right, the Republican Party has moved so far to the right that even a lot of Republicans are alarmed by the direction it's taken, and I mentioned the recriminations that are going on now. But the Democratic Party has also moved to the right as well, inexorably.
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with you on that.
Well, I was going to say, though, that the public in this last election appears to be showing that they're moving to the left. So are our politics out of sync with the public? That was my question.
Okay. Well, first of all, a little overview here. Actually, I got to give two overviews. One, if you look at political polarization, the higher you go in the hierarchy, the greater is the degree of polarization. So, for example, members of Congress, very polarized. Party people who work for candidates, general political activists, polarized, but not to the extremes of Congress. You work your way down to the ordinary American voter, and you don't see the same degree of polarization that you do in Congress. So this movement of left to right, right to left, doesn't mean quite the same thing on the ordinary citizen level as it does, say, on the congressional level. Secondly, if you look at how people have been responding in the last few years, what you get is a series of votes that basically said no. In 2006, the voters rejected what had been a Republican majority in Congress and elected a Democratic majority, making Nancy Pelosi an historic first as Speaker of the House. They said no to what was happening in the country. 2008, they elected a Democratic president, rejected a Republican president, re-elected a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. Once again, they said no. 2010, they also said no, but this time they rejected the Democrats and elected an overwhelming number of Republicans. 2012, they didn't make a move in either direction to the same degree they had in the previous three elections. They moved slightly left. They gave the Democrats a few more senators. They gave them a few more members of Congress. Obama won, but we should understand that the political prognostications that are made months in advance predicted that he would win. He did a little bit better than those prognostications would have predicted. But it was his election to lose, and he didn't lose it. So it's stretching it to say the American people are moving to the left. They're basically saying, we don't like what's been going on. We're looking for something different and something new. And they keep saying no to the Democrats and no to the Republicans. In this election, they gave a little qualified yes to the Democrats. It's not a big move in a blue direction.
So, Joe Freeman, but in these midterm elections, in the last one, of course, 2010, that was a blowout for the Republicans, and it's led to the sort of Tea Party takeover, if you will, of the Republican Party and the Republican House. My sense, and of course, the biggest donors, a lot of that was organized by Karl Rove, and the biggest donors were the American Petroleum Institute, and Karl Rove and others immediately got to working on the 2012 election, having installed a bunch of Republican governors in key swing states like Ohio. They set about through ALEC their voter suppression plans, and we know from the statistics in this recent election that the Democrats in the House got more votes from American people than the Republicans did, even though the Republicans have a substantial majority. So they've seriously gerrymandered the House. My sense...
That's what happens when you lose in a reapportionment year.
Exactly.
We're going to pay for that for the next 10 years.
Right, but doesn't this mean the fact that in this election, because it's a presidential election, more people showed up? My sense is that President Obama is going to have to campaign real hard in 2014 so that the Democrats can avoid another 2010.
Yes, he will. And he's going to have to show some successes, too, which the Tea Party Republican caucus is not going to want to let him do. They're going to do their best to make him look bad. One of the unfortunate aspects of current American politics, or should I say the current Republican Party, as again, and I'm comparing this to previous Republican parties under previous Democratic administrations, the current Republican Party in the House is less concerned with making policy, even policies they like, than they are with defeating the Democratic president. So they basically will go out of their way to make the Democratic president look bad, even if it sometimes means shooting themselves in the foot. That's what they've been doing the last 2 years, and they're going to keep doing it for the next two.
So what's your sense then, Joe Freeman, of whether this is a permanent, or this is the beginning of a permanent shift? A lot of Republicans are alarmed that they're not going to be able to sustain themselves over the long run if they continue to alienate women and minorities, the fastest growing group being Latinos. We can see what's going on in Arizona, how the old guard white Republicans are doing everything they can to inhibit and suppress the votes of the Latinos. So as long as that goes on, the demographic future of the Republicans doesn't look good, and conversely, it looks brighter for the Democrats. Is that inexorable, or can that change?
Well, it's not inexorable. First of all, you're right. Demographically, it looks better for the Democrats. It has for some time. It's been almost a decade in which the demographics have looked better for the Democrats than they did for the Republicans. And yet the Republicans have won some very big elections in that decade that it's looked better for the Democrats demographically. So keep in mind, the Republicans can overcome demographics. They have done it in the past. They can keep doing it in the future. They shift on some things when they have to shift. I think we should make a big distinction between social issues and economic issues. The Republican elites, the ones that you point out who are funding a lot of this, they're primarily concerned with economic issues. They don't really care about the social issues. Economically, they want limited government, little or no regulation, and low taxes. They will give in on the social issues to whomever can get them that. There is a strata in the Republican Party for whom the social issues is of primary importance. They're the ones who walk the precincts, work the phone banks, and generally add labor to the money that comes from the elites. But if the elites think they can win without them, if they can find another way to get their meet their economic goals without having to cater to the wishes of the social conservatives, they will. That may happen. That's a little hard to predict. That's probably why the Republican Party is in such turmoil right now, because they're not quite sure whom within their own party they need to work with to get what they want.
Well, but prior to this election, I often was I interviewed a number of people and historians and others going back to the Gilded Age, for example, and making connections to the current Gilded Age. And there's been a pervasive sense that the use of the word oligarchy and plutonomy has come more and more into our vernacular. And of course, the Occupy movement brought in the 99% versus the 1%. And it felt in many ways that this election was a referendum on the extent to which we are still a democracy and haven't totally become a plutocracy or a plutonomy with our polity captured by oligarchs. How do you see that situation, given that many of the plutocrats behind the big super PACs on the Republican side, the Sheldon Adelsons and company, and the Karl Rove's super PACs, in spite of hundreds of millions of dollars, they, you know, didn't win the election. And indeed, I'm sure Karl Rove has to answer to a lot of plutocrats as we speak.
Well, what that tells you is money only gets you so far in elections. I mean, money is an easy thing to talk about because you can count it, you can add it up, you can spend it, it's quantifiable. But everyone who studies elections will tell you money only gets you so far. You can't actually buy an election, at least not in the long run. It needs to have multiple elections over time. So that's why they're crying, because as much money as they had, they still couldn't win enough seats in enough places to feel fairly comfortable with that their policies would be pursued. There are other things that count, and we need to hope that our politicians will be able to utilize those things that count. One of which is educating the American people. Now, as Teddy Roosevelt said, the presidency is a bully pulpit. It's still a bully pulpit, only it's a bigger one than it was in his day. I certainly hope President Obama will use the presidency as an opportunity to educate the American people on the need for more progressive policies, the need to raise income tax, and not just on the wealthy. I mean, I really need to raise it on many more income earners than just those earning over $250,000. We need to pay for a lot of things if we're going to fund the programs that make this a society worth living in. He's got to sell that to the American people. The right wing has tried to say everyone should take care of themselves. We don't want government to take care of us. Those who can't afford to pay for it, that's just the way it is. The Republicans want everyone to believe that everyone should take care of themselves and maybe take care of their families, but that's it. That we don't have any other obligations to anyone else. As President Obama said many times, both during the Democratic Convention and afterward, we're all in this together. You look at the theme that was written large on the wall of the Democratic Convention. It said, Americans coming together. That's the basic message he needs to sell to the American people, that we are all better off if we all contribute to society so that we all can get something out of society. The Republican individualists take a very different tack. They basically want to say everyone should stand up for themselves, everyone should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, everyone should not be their brother's or their sister's keeper, And if things, bad things happen to you, look to charity. Don't look to government to take care of you. That's their message. Obama needs to look to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to sell the progressive message, the community message, to the American people if he wants to get his policies actually put into law.
Well, just in closing, Joe Freeman, the union movement, which is down to 6%, representing 6% of the private workforce now, played a very key role, for example, in Ohio, and other progressive organizations weighed in as well. Do you think that there's going to be some kind of quid pro quo here?
Oh, there's always a quid pro quo. Don't fool yourselves. I mean, the auto workers came all out for Obama in 08, and he rescued the auto industry. He didn't do it because he's in love with GM. He did it because he felt an obligation to the United Auto Workers. And, yes, that's exactly what's going to happen with Ohio. Now, keep in mind that labor also went all out in 2010 and got walloped rather soundly in 2010. One of the reasons they were able to be so successful in 2012 is because those reactionary who were elected to Ohio, you know, in Ohio in 2010 went around and put forth some policies which scared the bejeebers out of the Ohio voters. So they were ready to listen to the union message this time. But yes, will Obama be obligated to labor? Will Richard Trumka come knocking on his door and say, this is what we want? Absolutely, that's going to happen. Now, whether he can deliver or not is another matter. You don't get new laws unless they're passed by Congress. And Congress is still controlled by the right-wingers. So we don't know what's going to happen, but we certainly know that there will be a quid pro quo. I wouldn't quite put it a quid pro quo. There's a basic rule in politics. Take care of the people who take care of you. AFL took care of Obama in Ohio, and Obama's going to do his best to take care of the AFL.
Well, Joe Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joe Freeman, who's an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. As a student at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s, she became active in organizations working for civil liberties and the civil rights movement. She went on to do voter registration and community organization in Alabama and Mississippi and was an early organizer of the Women's Liberation Movement. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and find answers to questions that a lot of listeners have been sending in lately. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.